1460 WVOX.
1460 WVOX.
Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate and I'm joined by my co-host, Nina Lubin. We're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX 1460 AM and our very talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, how are you doing this morning, Nina?
Good morning, listeners. Hey, on balance, Tamar, doing fine. Wanting to be outside and active in this extended summer weather, but more often than not, I'm right here, indoors, sitting in front of one or more screens, you know, so it goes.
Well, it's
How
going
are you
to
doing?
Be beautiful. It's going to be beautiful, so I hope you make it out at some point.
I'm going to try.
Well, before we begin what promises to be another exciting show here at the Ballot Box, we have two important election items that we need to note. First of all, we're now almost a week and a half away from our next general election, which will be held on Tuesday, November 2nd, from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. throughout the county. The candidates on the ballot are running for local offices, but please note that the ballots also contain state, county, and local propositions. To find out exactly what's on your ballot, as well as voting and early voting locations and times, go online and search for League of Women Voters New Rochelle, and then go to election info. So you're going to search for League of Women Voters New Rochelle, and then go to election info. I urge everyone to vote. Remember, our democracy only works if you and all of us are part of it, so please, please vote.
And election item number two. Folks, I'm going to recommend a couple of websites in the next minute, so please grab a pencil and paper or notepad to jot them down. The United States, state by state, is in the midst of the once-a-decade redistricting process. New York's independent redistricting commission has released proposed new boundaries for congressional districts, state senate districts, and state assembly districts. And the mapmakers are looking for the first time for your input. If you'd like a basic redistricting 101 session for clarity around this fundamental democratic process, the results of which, by the way, you'll be stuck with for the next 10 years, go online and enter a simple search using the words redistricting 2021, League, and New York. Again, redistricting 2021, League, and New York. The commission's holding a series of in-person and virtual hearings about its draft maps throughout the state. Westchester will be spotlighted on November 8th. Details about the hearings and the proposed maps themselves can be found at the commission's website. Here it is, nyirc.gov. nyirc.gov. Redistricting is a constitutional process created to ensure one person, one vote. If, however, you find yourself in a gerrymandered district, that process has failed you. Get involved. Quoting my co-host, democracy works only if all of us are involved. Now, onward and upward with our broadcast.
Well, our regular listeners will recall that our September guest, New York Times editorial board member Jesse Wegman, spoke about the United States Constitution, focusing on the fact that since the founding of this nation, while almost 12,000 constitutional amendments have been proposed, only a mere 27 have been adopted. the whos, whats, and whys of this fact, as well as the founders' expectations that the Constitution could and should be continuously revised through generations, made for interesting learning.
Indeed. Jesse generously agreed to return this morning for another discussion at the intersection of history, politics, and America's future, this time focusing on the Electoral College. Wait, don't touch that dial. Jesse is the author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College, which was published last year. The book is clear, readable, with touches of humor, and answers the questions about the Electoral College that you've been afraid, or as I've been, too embarrassed to ask. It is grounded in historical fact and the proposition that a national president should be elected by the nation, not by a handful of swing states. Intriguing? Okay, let's jump in. Jesse Wegman, thank you for your time this morning, and welcome back to the Ballot Box.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Jesse, we're so happy to have you back. Before we take a deep dive into your book, let's begin with some background on why you chose to tackle the topic of the Electoral College, and also why now, because you wrote the book after the 2016 election, in which for the fifth time in U.S. history, the Electoral College and the popular vote didn't match. But you wrote it before the 2020 election. Did you anticipate a similar scenario looming?
Well, there's no question that given the way that the demographics and the politics and the partisanship of this country have been going, that we are headed toward a time of increasing risk of that split, of an Electoral College outcome that diverges from the popular vote outcome. And as you saw in 2020, we were extremely close to having it happen again. Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by almost the identical margins in the identical states that that Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump by 4 years earlier. So, you know, it was just a matter of a few thousand, a few tens of thousands of votes in a few states that changed the outcome of the entire election. And, of course, I think most Americans, you and I included, I think that is crazy. It's crazy that a few thousand votes randomly distributed in a few states that just happened to be closely divided themselves could swing an election in which 160 million people cast ballots. And yet that is how the system currently works. And I think that was what led me to want to write this book in the first place. Obviously, you know, I had been around for the 2000 election, which was the first time in living memory that the Electoral College had gone the opposite way of the popular vote when George W. Bush was won the White House, despite Al Gore having about a 500,000 popular vote lead in the country. That, you know, generated a whole lot of outrage and shock and people saying, wait a minute, how can that happen? You know, but a few things led that particular event to be undermined, or let's say swept under the rug pretty quickly. One of them was the fight in Florida, right? That became a battle over counting ballots, and then it went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court voted 5-4 in favor of George W. Bush. So it kind of got politicized in a slightly different way that took the attention away from the Electoral College. And then, of course, just a few months later, we had the September 11th terror attacks, which launched two wars, and you know, people were distracted and stopped thinking about the issue. So 16 years later, it happens again, but this time in a much quote-unquote cleaner fashion, where, you know, Donald Trump clearly loses the popular vote by 3 million votes around the country to Hillary Clinton, and yet because of these razor-thin margins in three states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, he pulled out the Electoral College victory. So after that, I just thought, you know what, I have to write about this. This doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit with our modern conceptions of democracy. I don't think anybody likes it, including Donald Trump himself, who a few years before 2016 called the Electoral College a disaster for democracy when he thought it was going to hurt him and his party. So that was why I decided to write the book, and that was the driving force.
Thanks, Jesse. We'll be back after the break to talk further.
Let's return now to the ballot box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the ballot box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Jesse Wegman, who is the author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. And Jesse, you were going to give us a little sketch of the winner-take-all laws, give us a brief understanding of what those are.
Sure. So when people talk about the Electoral College, and we argue about it today, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what we're even actually arguing about. And when we clear that up, you find there's a lot more agreement among the public than it looks like. The Electoral College in the Constitution, the part that people think that they're fighting about, is actually only a very bare-bones structure. All it says, mainly, is what I just described, which is it indicates that these electors are the people who pick the president by an absolute majority, and that they're allocated to the states based on their state's representation in Congress. That's pretty much it. There's a few other important details, but those are we can get into later. That is the bottom line in terms of its fundamental structure. Everything else about the Electoral College is decided by the states themselves, state legislatures. And that is what we end up fighting about, even though we don't realize it. So the biggest one of all of these state-decided elements of our system of choosing the president is what we call these winner-take-all laws. And winner-take-all laws are exactly what they sound like, which is a state decides that it is going to give all of its electors, however many electors it's been allocated under the Constitution, to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in that state. They give zero to the other candidate. It doesn't matter how close the election is in the state, it's all or nothing. And that is the fundamental feature of the Electoral College today, and that's what we're all arguing about. And I think when you describe it in that way, most people say, wait a minute, that's no fair. That doesn't make sense. And it doesn't matter what political side you're on, right? We think of this as a partisan issue where Democrats hate the Electoral College and Republicans love it. No, not true. You know, Republicans hate it just as much the instant that they think it's going to hurt them. And the reason that you know this is what I said earlier, is that on election night 2012, when it looked briefly to some people from exit polling like Mitt Romney could win the most votes in the country and yet lose the Electoral College to Barack Obama, Donald Trump tweeted, "The Electoral College is a disaster for a democracy," you know, because it's so kind of self-evident to people that this isn't a system that accords with basic principles of modern democracy, which are one person, one vote, everybody's vote counts the same, and majority rule. The person who gets the most votes wins. It's how we run every other election in the country except for this one. So the winner-take-all laws, which are actually in place in 48 of the 50 states, every state except for Maine and Nebraska use the winner-take-all laws, are entirely a state creation, and they can be overturned at the state level. States can choose different ways of allocating their electors to the candidates, and that's really, I think, what we're arguing about. So I want to emphasize that point for all the Democrats in Texas, for all the Republicans in California, who feel rightly that their votes every 4 years for president are completely erased because their states are winner-take-all. Millions, literally millions of Republicans in California might as well not count at all. Millions of Democrats in Texas and go across the whole country. That's what you see. It's the winner-take-all laws that lead to the results that we've seen where a popular vote losing candidate wins the presidency. And that's what needs to change if we're going to move forward in a modern democracy.
How does that change without, you know, having to run the constitutional amendment gamut?
Well, as we know from our last conversation, changing the Constitution is an extremely heavy lift, but you don't need to do it in the case of the Electoral College because, as I said, these are all state-level decisions. And one thing we can talk about is this effort over the last 15 years called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And it's a mouthful, but it really refers to just an agreement among a group of states to change the way that they award their electors. This is all exactly as the Constitution apprehends it, that the Constitution created it so that states could make these decisions on their own. There is absolutely nothing unconstitutional or wrong about this. Right now, you might say, we are living in an interstate compact where all 48 states have agreed to award their electors by winner take all. So this would change the way that states that agree to the compact award their electors. The way they would do it is to give their electors not to the winner of their state's vote, which is what happens today, but to the winner of the most votes in the entire country. And so when states representing a majority of electoral votes, 270, that's the number that you need to win to become president, when states representing that majority join in this compact, you end up automatically making the candidate who wins the popular vote in the country the president. And that has all kinds of very positive effect, I think, on our politics, on our democracy, regardless of who wins. And you know, it's something that none of us has ever experienced, because we've all assumed for our whole lives that this is just the way it is. But in fact, it's purely a function of states choosing to do this, choosing these state winner-take-all laws as a way to try to boost their own power, their own clout in the national election, but at the expense of a functioning democracy.
So where do you see that going at the moment?
Well, so right now there are 15 states plus D.C. that have joined this compact. Those states together, I believe, represent 196 electoral votes. So that means, do the math, there's 74 more votes to go, and then they get, you put this into effect, the National Popular Vote Compact, and the president would be elected by, effectively elected by a majority of the American people. Wherever they live, doesn't matter, it's the majority of the people will elect the president. The reason that's so important, and this is what's key here, is that when presidents only have to appeal to a few voters in, let's say, Arizona or Pennsylvania or Michigan or Georgia, wherever it might be, whatever our so-called swing states are in the given year, they will ignore the interests of the vast majority of Americans who don't live in those states. And what ends up happening is this distortion of our representative democracy, where the one person who is tasked with representing all Americans equally wherever they live is really only paying attention to the interests of a few thousand that they need to win to become president. Now, it's logical for them to do it this way, because that's the rules of the game today, and that's how you win. But it's definitely not healthy for American democracy. So, you know, we're arguing for days about fracking, you know, the politics of fracking, not because every American is interested in fracking, but because Western Pennsylvania, that's a big industry in Western Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania was a big swing state in 2020. So we hear all of these things about fracking, but not about all the issues that matter to the tens of millions of New Yorkers and Texans and Californians who live in states that were not competitive in 2020. When you make an election national for the presidency, you end up forcing the candidates of both parties to appeal nationally, to care about the things that most Americans care about. And in that regard, I think we get candidates who are more, I'm not going to use the word moderate, but who care more about the things that a majority of Americans care about. And that's really one of the fundamental attributes that we want in the leader of a democracy, of a representative democracy, is someone who's actually concerned to pass the kinds of laws and to enact and enforce the kinds of laws that the most people want, and not just a few small random groups around the country.
So, Jesse, the sequence of events is there is a national election, the entire country votes, there is a majority winner, and then everybody's electors automatically cast their vote for that majority winner.
Well, not quite, and sorry if I'm not explaining it clearly. The states still run their own elections. Elections are administered at the state and local level still. That hasn't changed. That's always been the case in American history, and it would still be the case under this compact. What's different is when the state counts their votes, what they're doing is adding their votes to the pot of the national vote, meaning when everybody adds together all of the votes from all the states, they say, who won the most votes in the country? So this year in 2020, it was Joe Biden. He won by about 7 million votes. So states that were members of this compact, regardless of how their own state voted, would say, we give all of our electors to Joe Biden because he won the most votes in the country. If Donald Trump had won the most votes in the country, they would have given all of their votes to him, regardless of how their own state voted. And you can hear kind of the grumbling, people saying, wait a minute, this, you know, our state voted the other way. But I challenge you, to find anybody who actually votes the way that they vote.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back to our last segment with Jesse Wegman, author of Let the People Pick the President. In his book, Jesse has very nicely prepared us for Thanksgiving with the families. He's taken a look at the arguments in favor of the Electoral College and responses to those arguments, and he's taken a look at arguments in favor of popular vote with responses to those to that argument. Jesse, can you give us like key arguments or myths or whatever they might be, one of each, and how a discussion might ensue?
Sure. You know, I think, as I was saying before the break, you know, so much of our debate is really littered with these myths and misunderstandings. I don't think it's, in most cases, I don't think it's malicious. I think it's just people don't know what they're talking about. And so we end up having this argument that isn't the real argument we should be having. It's fine for people to disagree, but I just want people to be disagreeing based on facts and not on myths. So, you know, one of these, the most common one that I hear is, oh, well, you know, if we didn't have an electoral college, the small states would have no voice. You know, it would be just the big cities. And usually the big cities are what people mean when they say the big cities are the coastal cities, right? Those are the sort of stand-in. And I think there's a lot of prejudices that actually come along with that about the kinds of people who live in the big coastal liberal cities. And, you know, or another way of putting it is people will say, oh, it's mob rule. You know, and I just always kind of chuckle when I hear that, because first of all, I mean, I don't know what mob rule means to people, but right now, the public, the people in every state choose the electors for their state. They are the voters. The voters choose who is going to be sent to the state capitol to vote for president. So right now, the mob is ruling. You know, there is no intermediary body helping to translate, you know, a crazy mob. First of all, I don't think the mob is crazy. I think the vast majority of people are pretty sensible and make pretty good decisions when aggregated about who will be president. But, you know, another, just on a statistical level, this is also wrong. It's not true that a few big cities in a few coastal states will dominate the outcome of the election. How do I know this? Because it doesn't actually happen right now. The cities are nowhere near big enough to overtake the rest of the country. They are a tiny fraction. People make estimates. They think, oh, you know, these cities and these states are 30, 40, 50, 60% of the country. They're actually a much tinier fraction of the country than that. And in fact, most people everywhere are casting their votes, as I said before, not based on where they live, but based on whom they support for president. That is a key point. People do not vote based on where they live. It might be that there are more Democrats in cities. It might be that there are more Republicans in rural areas. But people aren't voting that way because they live there. I think people end up in those places in part because of how they of their political affiliation. So I think we have the whole debate backwards. And I think it's really important to realize that most people vote, or virtually everyone votes, just for according to wherever they live, whom they support for president, and all of those votes should count equally.
So in terms of, I mean, that's in favor of a popular vote, but in favor of keeping the Electoral College, what, I guess, are the main arguments? I mean, you touched on, you know, one very important one, you know, the little guy has to have his voice heard in these small states. But what are some of the other arguments that they raise?
Well, just to be clear on that point, the small states right now are not protected under the way the Electoral College runs, which is that winner-take-all system, right? The small states, with the exception of one, New Hampshire, are not even close to being swing states. If we define small states as those with three or four electoral votes, which is the smallest number you can have, they are divided almost evenly between Democratic and Republican states. Those states are ignored by both candidates, just like all of the other so-called safe states every 4 years because their electoral votes don't matter, or trying to get their electoral votes doesn't matter because the candidates know where they're going to end up, right? Nobody questions where Vermont is going to go. Nobody questions where Idaho is going to go. So the small states right now under the system that we live under are completely ignored through the Electoral College as it operates today. Another one is, I think this is a common one. People say, okay, I accept your argument that this winner-take-all rule doesn't make sense. Well, let's do it by congressional district. Well, we know, we've looked at the numbers, we've run sort of, you know, sort of mock elections using congressional district, or another way to do it is by proportion, giving electors out by the proportion of the vote in each state. Those both sound on their face like a lot more reasonable, right? Well, wait a minute, 100-0 doesn't make sense. There's no state that votes its popular vote 100% for one candidate or the other. But these other systems are actually just as distorting of the outcome, if not more so, as the one we have today. So I think it's really important for people not to jump to that solution and say, oh, let's do it by congressional district. Remember, congressional districts are heavily gerrymandered, which means that they are drawn in ways that actually disenfranchise one party or the other. Today, it's usually Republicans disenfranchising Democrats, but Democrats definitely do it in reverse when they have the opportunity to. And we don't want to, that already infects our Congress and our state legislatures. We don't want to infect the presidential election with those same distortions. So I really think, you know, when you study this and you go into it, you realize you come back again and again and again to the same conclusion, which is the way to run an election is with all votes counting equally everywhere in the country, no matter where people live. That's known as a national popular vote.
Okay. National popular vote interstate compact. That, I assume, if people search on that, they will get the background, the information, the states that are already signed on, all of that information, correct?
You can Google that. You can read all about, there's other myths that you can read about online. You read my book, and I try to distill down, I think, what are the most common and most pernicious myths. But yes, there is more than enough to discover online about this. The bottom line really is that everybody everywhere wants to have a say, wants to have a voice in choosing the leader of the country, and they should. They are right to want that. We live in a modern representative democracy. Everybody should have an equal say in choosing the president. And it is a unique office, and it should be elected that way. And that's what I think is the key point people should take home, is that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or not affiliated with a party, you want your voice to count. And right now, tens of millions of Americans' voices do not count in the choosing of the president. That is wrong. It harms our democracy. It harms our politics. It harms our relationships to one another. And I really think we need to do away with it as soon as possible.
Jesse,
Thank you for presenting all of this. It'll be interesting to track a presidential election without hearing the phrase swing state.
Right, exactly. It's really that the whole country is a battleground state, and it should be treated as one by both candidates. And the way to do that is to have a popular vote, to treat everybody's vote as equal.
Jesse, you briefly mentioned in the beginning of this conversation James Wilson, who was actually a main architect of the Constitution, and I understand you're writing a book about him, so maybe you could give us a quick preview?
Sure. I know we're short on time. I'll just say James Wilson, I was ashamed not to know more about who he was as soon as I discovered, you know, he was the primary advocate for a national popular vote in the Constitutional Convention. And he was really one of the most important delegates at the convention. He was a Scottish immigrant who had completely different ideas about what a modern republic should look like than his colleagues. And he pushed for a lot of these. And he failed in a lot of cases, but he also prevailed in a lot of cases. And his story is a fascinating one. And the reason that he is forgotten, basically erased from American history, is also a fascinating and very tragic story. And so as soon as I started learning about him, I wanted to delve more into his personal story. So, I did a chapter basically on him in the Electoral College book. And then I said, as soon as this book is done, I got to switch over and do an entire book on James Wilson. So I'm working on that right now. I'm going to be traveling to Scotland to see where he grew up. I'm going to be traveling to Philadelphia, where he spent most of his life. And I'm really excited to tell the story. There has been no mainstream general interest biography of James Wilson in, ever in American history. So I'm excited to be able to introduce him to a lot of people out there who I think will be fascinated by his remarkably modern views on democracy. You know, he was a man 200 or 300 years ahead of his time, and he deserves more attention than he's ever gotten.
Looking forward to that book. What's your estimate? Are we talking months, years?
We're a couple years out now. I would say probably 2024 is when we'd see it.
Okay. So, first of all, Jesse, thank you. Let the people pick the president, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. I know we don't have time to do this, but just so our listeners know, you are not the first person to have proposed this, and in fact, earlier proposals have gotten a heck of a lot of attention and very close to being passed, the abolishment of the Electoral College. So do we have a second to just mention some of the key folks in the 60s and 70s? That push this forward?
I don't think so.
No, we don't. Okay,
that
get
music.
The book, folks. Let the people pick the president, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. Our guest, Jesse Wegman, New York Times editorial board member. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our next ballot box is Wednesday, November 17th at 9 a.m., and our final words to you are what, Tamar?
Don't forget to vote on November 2nd or earlier.
I knew those were them. Take care, everybody. Have a good day.
Take care.
Thanks for listening.
AM 1460 WVO.